that kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's start with Gaza, and let's start with the WCK drone strike.
So this has been the big news over the last couple of days. On Monday, the Israeli military conducted a drone strike against a World Central Kitchen aid convoy. The WCK is Chef Jose Andres' charity. It's been working in Gaza. It's been heavily involved in this idea of creating a maritime corridor to bring aid into Gaza and just generally delivering food aid to parts of the territory that have been struggling to access aid under the current conditions. The strike killed seven WCK aid workers. The Israeli government, the Israeli military have been at pains to argue that this was just a mistake. It was an accident. It was a miscalculation or a misidentification. It was unintentional. It was an oopsie, as it were. But Israeli media, even Israeli media, I should say, Haaretz, for example, the way this has been reported out, it seems like anything but an unintentional mistake. What happened, according to at least the Haaretz account, is that the IDF was tracking this convoy, and that makes sense because WCK had informed the IDF about the convoy and the route it would be taking. There were three cars escorting an aid truck to a warehouse in central Gaza. They tracked this convoy and I guess noted the presence of what they thought was an armed man who they decided, the Israeli soldiers decided, was Hamas or Islamic Jihad or some militant of some description on board this truck that they were escorting to the facility. The convoy made it to the facility. The truck stayed behind because it was unloading stuff at the warehouse. And these cars left without this allegedly armed man, phantom Hamas fighter, whatever. Nevertheless, the IDF decided to strike the convoy. These vehicles were clearly marked. At least one of them had a big World Central Kitchen logo on the roof, of all things. But they decided to strike the convoy. They fired at one of the vehicles, then waited while the people inside that vehicle evacuated to a second vehicle, then fired on that second vehicle, waited while the people in the second vehicle got out and went into the third vehicle, and then fired on the third vehicle. So it seems like a very methodical, intentional attempt to kill these people, which they did. They killed all seven of them. The fallout has been fairly substantial. The pains to which Israeli officials have gone to try and paint this as just wow, this is just an accident. It's the kind of thing that happens in war, I guess. We didn't mean to do it. That tells you that even Benjamin Netanyahu and senior figures in the IDF are feeling some concern about this.
As a professional military committed to international law, we are committed to examining our operations thoroughly and transparently. I just spoke to WCK founder, Chef Jose Andres, and expressed the deepest condolences of Israel Defense Forces to the families and the entire World Central Kitchen family.
There was an outrage statement from the White House, rhetorically, at least, much angrier than anything I've seen come out of the White House since the start of all of this back on October 7th about the strike. There has been, we'll get into this, there was apparently a very tense phone call between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu as a result of, partly as a result of this strike on Thursday. But there's been a great deal of scrutiny over the last few days about not just this attack and the excuses that are being offered and how they don't comport with what seems really to have happened, but also in general about the conduct, the Israeli conduct of the war and its targeting decisions and the processes that it uses to make those decisions, which we can also get into. But this does feel like, although it's 7 aid workers as compared with thousands of people and scores of other aid workers who have been killed over the last 6 months without generating really any significant outrage from places like the White House, this feels different. This is something that really seems to be sticking. Andres has issued a very angry statement, essentially alleging that this was intentional. And of course, he's a celebrity, not just, he's generally a celebrity chef, but he's also specifically a celebrity in the sort of liberal, humanitarian world. His comments certainly carry some weight with the kind of people who work in this administration, the Biden administration, and who are, in positions of power in D.C. So this feels a little different from past incidents. I don't expect it to actually lead to any substantive changes. And we can get into that, too.
Well, actually, why don't we talk first about the Biden Netanyahu phone call, and then we could talk a little bit about, as you were talking about, U.S.-Israeli quote-unquote tensions.
This is, these guys have got this down now to where they're like a two-man comedy team, Biden and Bibi, where they do this dance. Something happens and Joe Biden supposedly gets mad and he has a phone call with Netanyahu and then nothing changes and then we do it all over again. This time, there have been several readouts already or reports of this call that took place on Thursday that suggests that Biden was sterner than usual, I guess, with Netanyahu, that he was angry about this WCK incident and demanded essentially that Netanyahu and his government implement what I saw termed concrete and measurable steps to improve both the protection of aid workers in Gaza and the overall humanitarian situation. He then sent out John Kirby, the spokesgool for the National Security Council, and Antony Blinken, the nominal Secretary of State, to reiterate this message and to suggest that there could be policy changes adopted by the Biden administration if they're unhappy with how the Israeli government responds to these demands. I think that is the longest of long shots. I've also seen reporting suggesting that Biden pressured Netanyahu to be more flexible in ceasefire talks, which is somewhat incongruous with what the administration's position publicly has been about those talks, which is that it's Hamas that is holding up a deal, not the Israeli government. So that was interesting. But there was this phone call, supposedly, again, we're doing the dance of tensions are high. Now, the other thing to note here on the tension front, I guess, is that there was another call earlier this week on Monday between a number of Israeli officials led by Ron Dermer, who is the Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs. He's a longtime Netanyahu advisor, counselor. And Blinken and the White House National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. This was supposed to be for the Israelis to present finally their long-awaited plan for attacking Rafah, the city in southern Gaza that is on the hit list, but is currently home to over a million displaced Gazans, as well as other civilians who the Israeli government allegedly claims that it intends to get out of the way before it undertakes its assault. This was reported by a few outlets. NBC News was one of them. In their reporting, the meeting did not go well. The Israeli team presented a plan to evacuate civilians from Rafah into central Gaza, but it presented no details in terms of how it intended to house these people, It had little, they had some tents. There was some, the idea of building some tents or erecting some tents, but they had no real sourcing for the number of tents that they were going to need. They had no, there was no indication that they were planning for food or water or sanitation or medicine or any of the other things that you would need to kind of provide for the needs of over, again, over a million displaced people if they actually were able to evacuate them. And so Blinken and Sullivan pointed this out, I guess, and Dermer went apoplectic and yelled at them, got very angry. He's known, I guess, for doing this in meetings with the U.S. government, which is fascinating that they keep meeting with him, I guess. But yeah, so that's another, you know, indication. And again, maybe all for show. But another indication of some tension here that is supposedly building up.
Let's talk about the other big story when it comes to Israel this week, and that was the IDF's AI system or AI-assisted system called Lavender. What is it and why is it important?
Yeah, Yuval Abraham at Plus 972 Magazine, who's been reporting on this kind of stuff since October 7th, he's been doing a phenomenal job. He broke this story this week about an artificial intelligence system that the IDF is using. It's called Lavender. It is used basically to identify likely Hamas or Islamic Jihad or other militant targets, individuals who are, you know, I guess meet some pattern or some pattern recognition that goes into this that determines that they are likely to be militants of some description. The story is that the Israeli government basically, you know, right after October 7th, when it was it started going into Gaza, started bombing Gaza, turned its targeting over to this system. Now, they've been using another system that Abraham also reported on, the Gospel, which is a bit different. It identifies likely targets that are being, like likely sites, buildings, other things that are being used by militants or likely to be used by militants. This focuses on individuals. There were a number of shocking things in this report, and you know, people should, I would definitely urge people to read it. But among the most shocking things that Abraham reported for example, that the IDF, well, it knows that Lavender makes errors about 10% of the time, maybe more, but at least 10% of the time, nevertheless, it's just been adopting its target list wholesale, or at least was early on. That may have changed more recently, but was just adopting its target list wholesale. The only human input into this process has been apparently checking to make sure that the target was a male, thinking that it's unlikely that a woman would have any kind of position within a Gazan militant group. So that was the only check was, is this a man that wants us to target? Other shocking things here, the IDF has been preferring, not just willing to attack these targets when they're at home with their families, with their wives and children, in their residential neighborhoods. This isn't just something that the IDF is willing to do, although it has greatly relaxed rules of engagement to allow for higher numbers of civilian sort of collateral deaths in these incidents. But the IDF has adopted a preference for attacking these people when they're believed to be at home, because it's thought that it's more likely that you will get them for sure in their homes as opposed to trying to predict when they're going to be somewhere else. So there've been a lot of attacks on these targets in the evening when they're home from, again, with their wives and children, causing a number of civilian casualties that might otherwise be avoided. There's an ancillary system that they're using that's reportedly called Where's Daddy, and I'm serious about that, that is responsible for tracking these people and trying to determine when they are likely to be in their homes to be targeted. So, you know, just a lot of shocking stuff here. And again, that reporting combined with the triple tap strike on the WCK convoy is, I think, generating a lot of attention toward how the Israeli government is conducting this war. You've also had a number of stories break in Israeli outlets, the Times of Israel, Haaretz again, where you get sources within the IDF sort of complaining about, in one case, poor discipline among field commanders. In another case, in the Times of Israel report, they cited a culture within the IDF of shoot first and ask questions later in Gaza. This seems to me like an attempt to deflect from these systemic issues that are inherent in Gaza, in the occupation, and sort of blame a few bad apples in the IDF for spoiling the whole bunch, which is ridiculous. But that may be a concerted effort by the IDF in particular to try and launder its reputation here.
Let's talk about the Shifa hospital attack.
Yes, that attack had been going on for 2 weeks, was going on last time we talked and all through last week, finally ended on Monday with the IDF pulling out of the hospital. Now, the Israelis insist that that Shifa was being used by Hamas and Islamic Jihad as a command center. And so it was a legitimate military target, despite being a hospital and a working hospital. It had, you know, after being assaulted and basically destroyed or rendered inoperative earlier in this conflict, the facility had begun to see some patients again until the IDF showed up a second time. Shifa is the largest hospital in Gaza. It's located in Gaza City. The Israelis claim that they killed some 200 militants in the operation and arrested, I think, 900 or so other militants. But local accounts from the hospital, from, you know, people who have seen the wreckage, describe hundreds more people, and many of them civilians, dead, many people missing, a number of bodies found kind of bound and essentially summarily executed. The facility itself is in, much of it is in ruins at this point. So yeah, another fun atrocity that has been committed here. It's gotten less attention than I think it otherwise might have, simply because of the sheer number of things that have gone on in relation to this conflict. We haven't even gotten to the airstrike in Syria. That'll be in a moment here. But there's just been so much happening this week that I think it has slipped under the radar a bit.
What about political developments within Israel itself?
So there is a push for a snap election. This is being fueled by Benny Gantz, the former defense minister and now temporary ad hoc member of Netanyahu's war cabinet, as it were, who is calling for a snap election in September. He's doing this because polling strongly suggests that he would win. So, you know, obviously he would like to be prime minister. I wouldn't expect anything about his approach to this conflict to be any different than Netanyahu, but he is, you know, he's pushing for this. And of course, everybody's heaped all their complaints in the good liberal Israeli establishment, and the liberal establishment here in the U.S. They're all saying, well, it's Netanyahu's fault. It's not the occupation. It's not Israel. It's all Netanyahu. So this is a big deal for people to try and, you know, get rid of him. There's a lot of attention toward this. Now, Netanyahu, I've said this before when we've talked about the possibility of a snap election, he's not legally obliged to subject himself to another election until 2026. And he can read the same polls that Gantz does. So he knows he's likely to lose. And that, you know, so obviously he's would be unlikely to agree to a new vote. That said, the on-again, off-again controversy over the ultra-Orthodox Haredi community's exemption from Israel's mandatory military service has popped up again. The Supreme Court of Israel, which has been ordering that exemption be wound down, last week it ordered Netanyahu's government to end government stipends for yeshiva students. Now, this is, you know, one of the part of the condition for obtaining the mandatory military service exemption is that you have to be studying in a yeshiva. You get a stipend to do this. And that's how people get around it. The court has ordered that those stipends be done away with, which would make it untenable, I think, for a lot of these people to climb inside a yeshiva and stay there. Ergo, would be part of the process of winding down this exemption and forcing these people to do their service. The Haredi parties in Netanyahu's coalition have threatened, and, you know, we'll see if push comes to shove, but they have threatened to quit the cabinet if he attempts to enforce this court ruling. And if that happened, that would probably trigger an election because he would no longer have a parliamentary majority. So it is possible that could be a pathway toward what Gantz wants here, a snap election. But again, I think it's a long shot. The ultra-Orthodox parties, the far-right parties, all of them, you know, that are constantly threatening Netanyahu that if he does this or does that, they'll walk out on him. They all need him to be in power. Otherwise, you know, they will be fringe opposition parties again. So I think there's going to be some reluctance on their part to actually follow through on the threat, but we shall see.
Let's talk about the Israeli airstrike in Syria, and particularly the fact that it killed IRGC officers, that is, officers from Iran.
Yes. So an Israeli airstrike hit the Iranian embassy in Damascus on Monday, killed, at last count, I saw at least 13 people, seven of them members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who is the senior ranking IRGC officer in Syria. And the highest ranking IRGC officer to be killed since the infamous drone strike that assassinated Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force, back in January 2020, the U.S. drone strike.
As of late, they have a much more aggressive posture, more attacks. They're even being less restrained when it comes to casualties. They're going after members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. In fact, a member of the Revolutionary Guard was killed in these strikes a few days ago in their Zur. So this is Israel's stated aim. It is to degrade and weaken Iran in Syria.
This is easily, I think, the most provocative thing the Israelis have done in their kind of low-level back and forth with Iran and its various proxies since October 7th. It was shocking, obviously attacking an embassy is considered at least a norm, if not a rule, of the rules-based order. So that it was shocking just for that, but the fact that they killed so many members of the IRGC, there are fears now of an Iranian retaliation that could pull everybody into a wider regional war. And that, when I say everybody, I mean including the United States. The Iranian government has pledged to retaliate, but the Iranian government has been very cautious about how it responds to Israeli attacks against it, against Hezbollah, against other Iranian proxies since October 7th. It's clear that the Iranian government does not want a regional war, especially one that would bring the United States into it. And so I don't know that I think there will be a retaliation. I don't know that the retaliation is going to come directly against Israel. It may be we may see a renewal of attacks against U.S. military personnel in the Middle East because the Iranians will count on the fact that the Biden administration doesn't want to get sucked into a regional war either. So that may be the way this is coming. That said, the Israeli military is apparently on high alert, waiting for some kind of response from Iran. They have canceled leave for IDF personnel. They're keeping everybody at readiness. They've supposedly scrambled GPS signals in Israel to try and potentially confuse Iranian drones or missiles. So, definitely the Israeli government feels like a retaliation may be coming. And I don't know. We'll have to see. But definitely a shocking escalation in this back and forth that's been going on.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. please consider becoming a subscriber at AmericanPrestigePod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Speaking of strikes, why don't we talk about the recent drone strike in Myanmar?
Yes, this is this just took place on Thursday. National Unity Government, which is this the umbrella kind of government in exile for groups that are opposed to Myanmar's military junta, claimed responsibility for a drone strike on Naypyidaw, the capital of Myanmar. They claim they attacked two targets, the airport, the city's airport, and a military headquarters. There's no independent information suggesting at this point that the attack was successful. The military, Myanmar military, says that it shot down or intercepted all of the drones. It did acknowledge that the attack took place, but says it thwarted it. There has been some reporting to the effect of like the airport had to be shut down, but I haven't seen anything outside of what the National Unity Government has claimed to suggest that any of the drones actually made it to a target and caused any damage and or casualties. Nevertheless, I think this is, again, we've been talking about the progress of Myanmar's civil war. That the NUG was able to carry out an attack like this using apparently like over a dozen drones against the capital of Myanmar certainly seems to feed into kind of analysis that the junta is losing its grip on the country. So I think it's noteworthy just from that perspective.
And North Korea has tested a hypersonic missile. Derek, should I be fleeing Seattle? Yes or no?
No, you shouldn't. Don't worry about Seattle. I think you're okay. The North Korean state media reported earlier this week that the military had successfully tested a new hypersonic missile. It's intermediate range, so I don't believe it can hit any part of the continental 48. States of the United States, even the Pacific Northwest, I think you're okay. But it does have a range that brings pretty much all U.S. military facilities in the Pacific into range, and Alaska, I believe, could also be targeted. Now, this is an important step in the development of North Korea's missile program. Hypersonic missiles are, of course, regarded and maybe erroneously regarded as this super weapon because of their speed and maneuverability, that they can't be intercepted. We've seen reports of Russian hypersonic missiles being intercepted in Ukraine in that conflict. So I'm not sure. I think that may be overstated. Nevertheless, the missile is of a range that, again, does threaten U.S. military targets. It is apparently solid fueled, and we've talked about this as well. The North Koreans have been working on solid fuel missile technology for a while now. The advantage of solid fuel missiles is that you can fuel them and store them ready to fire, because solid fuel is stable enough to store in the vehicle, as opposed to liquid fuel missiles that have to be taken out and then fueled, and that there's a lot of lead time that goes into that, during which, for example, a preemptive attack could take your missiles out. If you have solid fueled missiles, you don't have to worry about that. You can launch them on fairly short notice. So these are a couple of important developments, I think, from the North Korean perspective. But I don't think you have to build a bomb shelter or anything like that.
No bomb shelters. You heard it here from Derek. Let's talk about the election results in Senegal.
Yes, we've talked about Senegal's disjointed political process. There was supposed to be an election, presidential election there in late February. The president at the time, Macky Sall, tried to postpone it until at least December. The country's Supreme Court shot that down. He then tried to reschedule it for June. The court again shot it down. So he finally acquiesced to holding the election on March 24th. In a shocking, I would say, result. The opposition candidate, the main opposition candidate, Basiru Diomaye Faye, won the election. Now, Faye was in prison as recently as March 13th. He was let out on March 14th, along with his patron, Usman Sonko, who is the really preeminent opposition figure in the country. They were both released as part of a general amnesty on March 14th, ahead of the election. But I'm not sure how many people really saw this coming, really saw Faye winning the election, having come from where he was. So this is a fairly significant development. He appointed Sonko as his prime minister. So now the two of them will have a sort of co-executive thing happening. We'll see if they can maintain that. But it's certainly a break with the status quo in Senegal. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think the upshot from in terms of what we've been talking about on this show with all of Saul's machinations, clearly they didn't work. I mean, they blew up in his face, basically, because I think part of the reason that Faye won was that people, there was a backlash against Saul, and that benefited the opposition. People were tired of him trying to screw around with the election date and try various ways to stay in power, and they made him pay for it.
Somalia has expelled its Ethiopian ambassador. Discuss.
Yes. Another thing that we've talked about before is this naval base deal that the Ethiopian government has concluded a few months ago, back in January, with the unrecognized regional government of the separatist Somaliland region. The Somali government has been furious about that deal for, since it was agreed. So, it's been about 4 months, 3 months now, I guess. So they have been, really angry at the Ethiopians. There have been fears that this could trigger some kind of regional war. The Somali officials have talked in very stark terms about their willingness to go to war to prevent Ethiopia from recognizing Somaliland's independence, for example, which seems like it would be the ultimate goal of this arrangement. So on Thursday, that took another step forward, basically, and the Somali government expelled Ethiopia's ambassador from Mogadishu. It recalled its own ambassador from Addis Ababa. It also ordered the closure of Ethiopian consulates in Somaliland and in the autonomous, not separatist, but still autonomous region of Puntland. The governments of both of those regions basically said they're going to ignore that order and leave the consulates open. And I'm not sure there's much the Somali government can do about that. But nevertheless, tensions here are still obviously quite high.
Derek, while you were so inconsiderately on vacation, there was a big story in Russia. There was this attack in Moscow. Could you tell us what it was, why it's important, and what we know about it now?
Yes. On March 22nd, there was a terrorist attack on the Crocus City Hall concert venue just outside of Moscow. The death toll, the last I saw, was had risen to 144 people.
In the concert hall area farther inside, concertgoers can hear the shooting outside. Then the attackers burst into the arena itself and start executing people in cold blood, one by one.
Islamic State, through its Khorasan affiliate, which is the group that's active in Afghanistan, claimed responsibility for the attack. It does seem fairly clear that they were the people, the men on the ground who carried out the attack, were affiliated with Islamic State. There have been a number of arrests of people in Russia and in Tajikistan of individuals connected both with this attack and with Islamic State. That seems to would seem to confirm that. Nevertheless, the Russian government, several Russian officials have been keen over the last week plus to blame not Islamic State, but the Ukrainian government, and by extension, the U.S. government and the U.K. government, other Western governments that are backing Ukraine, having ultimate responsibility for this attack. Their thinking, I gather, is that Ukraine, with the support of these Western governments, basically brokered with Islamic State to carry out the attack. This is not entirely out of the question. I mean, certainly it's within the realm of possibility. The Russians, to my knowledge, have not produced any evidence yet to support this claim, just a lot of suspicion. I suspect if they had any evidence, they would be making some hay out of it publicly. So, you know, we don't have much to go on in terms of assessing the claims that they're making. Obviously, the U.S. government, the Ukrainian government, all these other governments in question have denied any involvement. You know, there are, again, here, like with the case of the Iranians in Israel, there are have been fears that Russia would use this attack as a pretext to escalate things in Ukraine. That hasn't happened yet either. So I'm not sure how much to make of that.
So let's talk about NATO and this Ukraine fund that it seems to be developing, perhaps.
Yes. So first of all, I think we should say happy birthday to NATO.
Happy birthday, NATO.
It is NATO's 75th birthday.
Happy birthday music here.
Absolutely. It is NATO's 75th birthday.
Yep, 49.
It doesn't look a day over 74. I don't know.
It's younger than both presidential candidates.
Well, that's true. Younger than both presidents. Oh, that's nice. Okay. It's good to live in a functioning democracy. Anyway, NATO foreign ministers are meeting this week. They started, they met on Wednesday, and I think it was Wednesday, Thursday, they were going to be meeting, partly to commemorate the 75th anniversary, also partly to discuss the idea of a creating a 100 billion euro fund, that's about $108 billion at current exchange rates, fund basically to support, to provide military support for Ukraine over the next 5 years. What's interesting about this, and it's not anywhere close to being agreed to internally, let alone, you know, are they in a position to roll it out? But what's interesting about this is that NATO as an institution has not gotten involved in sending weapons to Ukraine. It has sent non-lethal military support to Ukraine, but it has not sent weapons. Obviously, a number of NATO members have individually been sending weapons, but there was a decision taken early on after the Russian invasion of Ukraine that to get the alliance directly involved in that way of, you know, directly sending weapons might be seen by the Russians as an intolerable NATO entry into the war and might risk escalation. Those fears, I guess, have dissipated. And what's concerning the alliance now is that the vagaries of politics in the various NATO member states could affect their ability to continue providing military support for Ukraine. That's certainly true in the U.S. Joe Biden's Ukraine aid bill, or his, you know, overall military supplemental bill, is still essentially languishing in the U.S. House of Representatives in limbo. Donald Trump's possible election in November would undoubtedly, I think we can assume, lead to substantial change in U.S. policy toward Ukraine. So there is a hope, I guess, that if you create this fund, this NATO fund, it would insulate at least that much military aid from the twists and turns of Western politics. But again, I don't think they're anywhere close to actually being able to roll this out or to even say that they have internal unanimity on the idea.
So let's go to the Western Hemisphere. And Derek, I know we were going to talk about the Havana Syndrome, but I'm going to call an audible. Everyone, we're going to have a special on that with Natalie Schur. If you're interested in Havana Syndrome, check out that special. We go very deep into it. So let's talk about the UN update on displacements in Haiti.
Yes. A new report from the UN's International Organization for Migration finds that the violence that's been gripping Port-au-Prince for over a month at this point, started late February, the insurgency in Port-au-Prince that we've talked about this. It's displaced over 53,000 people. And that's just between, I think, March 8th and March 27th, according to the report. This is, I think, the most specific figure that anybody's offered for the level of displacement to date. What is of particular concern is that these people are fleeing the capital because it's become intolerable to be, you know, in several parts of the capital. The violence is just making it intolerable for people to be there, but they're fleeing out to other parts of Haiti that just don't have the capacity to handle an influx of that many people. There's no facilities. There's no, place for them to go, really, where they can actually have their basic humanitarian needs met. So this is of great concern. And the longer the violence continues, the more people are going to be fleeing it into, you know, uncertain futures, I guess, at least in the near term. There is still this, I think we talked about this before I went on vacation, the presidential council or transitional council that the Caribbean community is trying to form to govern Haiti, with minimal input from Haitians as usual, is still taking shape. It still hasn't actually formally rolled out. Technically, Ariel Henry, even though he's submitted his resignation, is still prime minister of Haiti because this council hasn't been officially formed yet. He's resigning whenever that actually happens. There were reports of new heavy fighting between the insurgents and police near the National Palace in Port-au-Prince on Monday. That's another thing to watch out for, because the insurgents could try, if they can settle on somebody that they would like to see running Haiti, they could certainly present that person as an alternative to this council. The UN, again, to go back to their figures, says that around 1,500 people or 1,500 or more people have been killed in all of this fighting since it began in late February.
Thanks, Derek. And we're going to conclude with something we haven't heard about in a while, and that is the new Cold War. Derek, tell us about Biden and Xi's phone call.
Yeah, this is a new Cold War, and actually not totally grim news. So we're concluding on a maybe a little bit of a positive note. I don't know. Joe Biden and Xi Jinping spoke on Tuesday by phone. It's the first time that they had talked one-on-one since their summit in California back in November. They, from what I've been able to take from various reporting about the phone call, they talked about the issue of military-to-military cooperation, which was a big item on the agenda in November, the idea of getting the U.S. and Chinese militaries communicating directly on a regular basis again. They talked about counter-narcotics efforts, and I assume that means fentanyl, the shipment of fentanyl related chemicals from China that are winding up in the US, I guess, or in Mexico where they're processed. They talked about Taiwan, they talked about tensions in the South China Sea, they talked about China's relationship with Russia, they talked about TikTok, something else that I believe we'll be talking about on this show at some point. So, there was a wide ranging discussion, apparently. But I think the big takeaway is that it seems to have gone OK. There was no major incident. That summit in November produced a lot of positive feeling in a relationship that had not had very much of that in for months prior to that. It seems like we're still on OK terms, still talking. There haven't been any, balloon of death incidents creeping up since then. So things seem okay. There's not really anything substantive to say about this, but just the fact that the U.S. and China are talking to one another really is a positive thing, I think.
Well, on that beautiful note of friendship and amity, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.